easy, and you'll be contacted within 24 hours of the next business day to arrange for your free and easy vehicle pickup. Thank you for supporting 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Coming up next, Technology Bites.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to Technology Bites.
Whoa!
Much energy.
We did not discuss this in our meeting.
Much wow.
Turned a new page.
You turned a new page?
Yep.
Man page.
Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And Groovehouse is not here.
Oh.
Perfect show.
Did someone leave?
And we're done.
I think we left Flicted in turbo mode.
Did we? I mean, he's been coming in a little early. I mean, that's the way I've always wanted it to be.
There was food today. So
he sounds overclocked.
Here early.
Well, you know, the intro is a little long.
Groovehouse also isn't here to tell me not to, to go ahead and start.
Is he the one that has been holding you back?
Don't do it.
Are we going to just rag on Groovehouse tonight because he's not here to defend himself? He didn't want to be here because Pete's in the studio.
Wow.
Yeah, they have like a catfight thing going on.
Yeah, feud. It's a big feud thing. Where
they're beefing.
Where, you know, when it comes to fun drive time, there's going to be the Groovehouse faction and
H-Town and San Antonio.
And we'll compete for something.
It's actually, like, we, you know, we haven't rarely seen Pete and Groovehouse in the same room together.
Are they the same person?
All right, well, welcome to the show. We're glad you're here with us tonight. We're going to have Pete in the studio, so that's going to make the dynamic a little bit more exciting. Flicted's already ramped up and ready to go, so that's good. You can visit us online at www.geekradio.com. That is our website. Mostly it's podcasts and show links and news information and the occasional geek gathering.
Barrett, you look like you're building a visual demonstration for this radio show.
No.
Is that the poison tap?
This is poison tap.
Poison tap.
Yeah, this
right.
is the sub $5 little piece of, you know, hardware that will own pretty much any workstation out there.
Gonna,
if it's got a web browser open in the background.
Are you going to pwn us all live?
I'm trying not to pwn myself right now. I'm having a really hard time getting everything working without actually messing things up. I need two laptops. Does anyone want to plug this in?
No.
Anybody free USB port? Anyone?
Sorry. No.
Okay.
I do.
You do?
Well, what is it? I mean, what would be the effect? What would it do?
There's a little thing. It's the Raspberry Pi Zero. They've cut out. Like,
so what is a Raspberry Pi, for those that don't know?
Raspberry Pi. It's a little bitty, tastiest. Like, system on chip, you know? Little,
a what? It's a computer. It's a little tiny computer.
Hold on. Is this a tech show? I was told there'd be no math.
You're speaking using facts that are not necessarily in
tiny
evidence.
Hobbyist computer.
I've got an open USB.
Oh, there we go.
He's holding up a USB charger.
All it does, you put more or less a distribution of Linux on there. This one's running Raspbian.
And it's about the size of two postage stamps.
Yeah, it's pretty tiny. You could fit this in like a very large USB looking, very suspicious looking USB dongle. You can get it down smaller.
You could put it in one of those novelty USB dongles that looks like, you know, an RV or duck.
Oh, yeah.
So a penguin.
Yeah. So the idea is that this pops up. It shows up to the computer, whether it's from a Linux computer, OS X computer, or Windows computer, shows up as an Ethernet address.
It's Mac OS now.
Mac OS. Ooh. Mac
now.
OS. Mac OS.
Sorry.
Shows up Mac as, but not only does it show up as that, it shows up as the loopback address, like localhost. So the weird thing is,
0.0.
Yeah, almost pretty much. So it gets the first byte at any traffic on the system whatsoever. So it actually
::1.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, this is like, hey, you don't need to go to the internet for your web traffic. Let me give you your web traffic. So you can load persistent backdoors. You can change
what
passwords. You can get to the system registry. It's just a set
does
of
it
Python
act like a what is that CIH?
No. HID, human interface device. Yeah, no, it actually shows up as a more or less an Ethernet device.
But then why would the web browser go to it?
Oh, because it shows up as more or less like a loopback device. Not the loopback, but it shows up on the same level as loopback. So any IP4, IP6 traffic that goes out, it gets first grab at it. So it can take it more or less, quote unquote, off the wire, say
loop
whatever
back
it wants
mountain?
To do.
Why can't I quit you, Raspberry Pi?
Because I've got a persistent backdoor in you.
Hey-o.
That's totally, totally technically correct.
I'm not going there.
We'll have to bring this out to the Geek Gathering. But I read a lot about it, and so the good side of this is, like, if you've got a computer that you lost your password on or what have you, like, instead of, you know, going to booting into, like, you know, running NTPassword or something to reset that admin password, if the machine has a web browser in the background that someone accidentally left open, just give it a little bit of time, and you can get into the machine this way and reset the password on. So it's pretty nice, but it just gets to show you that you can't really trust USB anymore.
Does it respond to Tracer T?
Trace, no, nothing.
Nothing.
That
nothing
advanced.
Nothing
that's
can overpower Tracer T.
That's some next-gen hacking kind of tools that we don't have access to here.
Yeah, so come to the next geek gathering. We're going to scatter these in the parking lot.
Get owned.
USB drives all through the parking lot, and just pick one up and plug it right in.
Bring
and
your
see
Tracer
how it works.
T.
I did want to mention that we are having our geek gathering a week from Friday. So that information is up on.
I might actually be there.
Really? Are you going?
I know it's crazy, but I'm going to.
I know. I'm wigged out.
I'm gonna really, really try. Couldn't do it last month, or I guess at the beginning of this month, because I was in the Ars Technica All Hands meeting, which is our once a year gathering. We all see each other and
bring your hands.
Bring all of the hands and wave around. But yeah, no, I definitely would like to make it to this.
Love to see you.
This one we'll see. The problem for me is the first week of December. I have a spousal birthday that always happens, and so that kind of That's a real tough ask, just depending on the circumstances.
I hope the weather's going to be nice. I hadn't actually looked. Let me see.
It said thunderstorms, but that's still
10 days out, 9 days out.
Yeah, okay. It is.
Yeah, it'll be Hurricane Otto will have circled around and come back up the coast and hit Houston. Possibly. Maybe.
Let's see here. 10-day weather forecast for the Houston area looks like... next Friday, it looks like it says high of 73 and 50% chance of rain.
Wow, see, that's, yeah.
That's your weather traffic together on the 8th.
Welcome to the new format.
That's weird. The Facebook invite stuff has started giving, you know, weather reports along with the invite time and place, which I guess is good.
You know,
Kind of random.
Ah, what's going on this coming Monday? It's going to be gross.
It was kind of gross today.
I know.
As Facebook says they're not a news site, they suddenly introduced weather reports.
Yeah. Oh, well, the worst part is the fake weather reports, though. Yeah, tomorrow is swimsuit weather, so make sure and wear yours.
Psych.
All right. Well, so you can also play with us on the IRC, irc.geekradio.com or irc.failure.net.
Cuckoo.
No cuckoo.
No cuckoo.
Not doing that anymore.
No,
is it finally
dead?
Dead?
Bird died.
Deprecated.
I think it's what? Failure.net.
So,
it's
.com.
Come into the channel Tech Bytes, and there may or may not be people there. I haven't checked it yet. But
I was trying to reconnect too quickly. I got throttled.
Apparently. Throttling.
I got in. I see Ophelia Nakaden, N-A-Q-A-D-E-N.
Are you in the wrong channel again?
Nakaden and Virtual Afflicted. Not the real Afflicted.
Like Virtual Afflicted.
Not the real Afflicted, but an incredible simulation.
Afflicted left like and then came back. Afflicted, you okay?
Mania.
That's not the real Afflicted.
No?
That's Virtual
exact
Afflicted.
Exact copy with identical memories.
He's eating more Chinese food.
Ask him emotionally charged questions and look at his pupils.
There's a turtle.
Tell us...
You're in the desert.
Only in simple terms, the good memories about your mother.
Huh. All right. So, anyway.
Google Blade
Runner.
It's from
the movie, man.
Yeah, it's Blade Runner.
It's Blade Runner, man.
All right. I'm too hip to be cool.
What happens when they reboot it? That's my question.
So, not to derail, we're going to
join
come back.
Us.
We're going to have we're going to
an adventure in the
Westworld conversation.
I don't think I've seen the last. Have I seen the last Westworld?
Well, the last one.
Last two.
When was the last one? That was Sunday or something.
Yeah.
Or, no, I've not.
I didn't
seen
want to
the
have it right
one.
Now, but I just wanted to have you prime your pumps for
but
the Westworld conversation.
Last Sunday. Was the reveal of the reveal.
Yes, I got
the
that.
The reveal that kind of made Lee, did it go against the Lee theory?
It went a little bit against. It made me a little unhappy, but it was at least done in a very, very compelling and well-done way. Brutal way, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so before we go down Westworld town.
Go down west.
Before we head west, young nerd. We're going to go to San Antonio, realize that Pete's not there.
Come
all the way back to the studio.
Caught in traffic, half the trip.
Half full on Chinese food.
Stop at Bucky's.
Do you stop at Bucky's?
No.
No.
Aww.
No, I love that because you get near that exit, though, and there's a lot of bozos get out of the way to go to Bucky's, and you just go
It just opens up your lane, and there off you go. All right. We're going to go and do the Technology Bytes Info Shot. So take it away, Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, we're sort of, I think we're kind of required to do trigger warnings when there's any possibility of politics in news stories.
Are we providing a safe space?
yes, okay. Like at the theater. Anyways, on
other
the radio,
than that, how was
space.
The play, Mr. Pence?
it's not heavy politics, but it is President Barack Obama awarding the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The cool part on this one is, the usual arties and sport dudes and that got stuff, but so did the sciences and particularly American computer scientists. The class of 2016 had two women who played crucial roles in American computer science in the 20th century, Margaret Hamilton and Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, who was given the award posthumously. Here's how the White House described the pair. Margaret Hamilton led the team that created the onboard flight software for NASA's Apollo command modules and lunar modules. A mathematician and computer scientist who started her own software company, Hamilton contributed to concepts of asynchronous software, priority scheduling and priority displays, and human-in-the-loop decision capability, which set the foundation for modern, ultra-reliable software design and engineering. Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, known as Amazing Grace and the First Lady of Software, was at the forefront of computers and programming development from the 1940s through the 1980s. Hopper's work helped make coding languages more practical and accessible, and she created the first compiler, which translates source code from one language into another. She taught mathematics as an associate professor at Vassar College before joining the United States Naval Reserve as a lieutenant during World War II, where she became one of the first programmers of the Harvard Mark I computer and began her lifelong leadership role in the field of computer science. So, The Wired wrote a brief profile of Hamilton in October 2015. Now, no, not that Hamilton. This isn't the Hamilton. Now, see, I'm waiting for this. This one would be a good one, too, I think, the Broadway show, because it could be, like, right down the street, and then you have to figure out which one.
You're going to Lunar Hamilton or President Hamilton?
Put it in binary underneath so that only the people who can understand the code can know which one, that they're getting to the right one.
Yes.
Anyways, no, Wired wrote a brief profile of Hamilton in October 2015, which noted that Hamilton took great pride in her code and made sure that it was in tip-top shape. She told the magazine that she worried about flaws in her code and commented that, quote, that she, quote, was always imagining headlines in the newspapers, and they would point back to how it happened, and it would point back to me. So there's the original programmer worried that they're going to – one, that their code ain't so great, which isn't that pretty much – every programmer who should worry about that probably doesn't, but every programmer who probably is doing okay
does need to be. You need to be worrying about it.
Anyways – in September 2016, the United States Naval Academy announced that it would name its future cyber building after Hopper, who passed away in 1992 at the age of 85. So yeah, so girls, when you hear that, you know, when there's a whole thing where, oh, you shouldn't work with computers, well, there's actually a movie coming out very soon about with Margaret Hamilton,
Hidden Figures,
and so that would be one worth watching. But
there's actually a convention, Grace Hopper convention, that's been around for I'm not sure how many years, at least 5 to 7 years, I'm pretty sure. But the last 2 years, actually, it was in Houston. It was just maybe a couple of weeks ago, and it's for women in tech.
Oh wow!
16 years, that's awesome.
I was gonna say it's been a while, but it was just a couple of weeks ago because I was downtown and I saw people walking around with the Grace Hopper convention name tags and stuff, and so I stopped a couple of them and talked to them for a little while just. Because I knew who Grace Hopper was, but I didn't really know what the convention. I kind of had a guess, but I just wanted to ask somebody. So, but it's for women in tech. There's all kinds of companies are represented. They have recruiters there. A lot of women give presentations about being a woman in tech, or you know how to do different things as a woman in tech, stuff like that. It seemed like it was pretty cool. I didn't go to it. I just talked to a couple people that were going to it.
Awesome, yeah. Well,
and they said it was, I want to say that the person, because it just so happened that one of the ones I picked was one of the people who was giving a talk and was really into, and I want to say she said there was over 27,000 women there. I think. It was a big number.
Wow. Sort of.
That's a convention.
It was at George R. Brown.
Maybe that's why there weren't any in the Valley that week. Anyways,
yeah, and Hamilton, to touch on her real quick, did when you consider the task that the MIT Instrumentation Lab had to do in the run up to Apollo, it's actually pretty incredible because they didn't just write software to run the Apollo guidance computer and do all of this real time computing tasks in an ingenious way. They did it without any best practices or books for the first time, and in the process of writing the code, actually invented most of the tenets of modern real-time computing.
And how hand-wound memory core.
Right, yeah. That was how it ended up being translated. Hamilton ran the software engineering group at the MIT Instrumentation Lab, and there were two main chunks of code in the Apollo guidance computer. One's called the executive, and that was like the overall scheduler, and the other was called the interpreter, which is kind of a virtual machine, a very primitive virtual machine that allowed the Apollo guidance computer to execute operations it didn't have hardware to execute, like vector math and trig functions, because the hardware could only do addition. And I think I'd have to go look that up. But I know that the code that she personally touched, she was mostly responsible for work on the interpreter. So this is someone who was programming what was in effect a virtual machine thing to enable virtual computing to happen to do math that was unsupported by hardware. Again, in 1964, 5, 6, 7, and the lead up to Apollo. I mean, it's amazing stuff.
Pretty badass, I think, would be one way to describe it. But
definitely.
Yeah. So
definitely.
Anyway, so I guess that's all we got on that one. Now it's a bunch of hackery stuff. So if that's a trigger warning for you, well, you've really come to the wrong show in general. No, this one. Here's a new place that, there's the people who put a piece of tape over their webcam.
Which include paranoid, everybody.
Truly paranoid ones worry about their devices' microphones. Some even crack open their computers and phones to disable or remove the audio those audio components so they can't be hijacked by hackers. Now one group of Israeli researchers has taken that game of spy versus spy paranoia a step further with malware that converts your headphones into makeshift microphones that can record your conversations. So now you throw away your headphones, too.
That used to be the old trick that we would do, like when we were in school and we didn't have microphones, is you can plug your headphone into the mic jack and it won't work very well.
Get that great 1927.
Yeah, but it would work when, like, I need to record something real quick. Let's do something dumb, and you'd plug it in and it would work.
Yeah, that's what I used to do all the time, too. Yeah, I didn't have a mic, so use headphone as a mic.
Researchers at Israel's Ben-Gurion University have created a piece of proof-of-concept code they call Speak ear, they put A in parentheses in at the end of the word.
Oh, clever.
Designed to demonstrate how determined hackers could find a way to surreptitiously hijack a computer to record audio even when the device's microphones had been entirely removed or disabled. The experimental malware indeed repurposes the speakers in earbuds or headphones to use them as microphones, converting the vibrations in the air into electromagnetic signals to clearly capture audio from across a room. People don't think about this privacy vulnerability, says Mordecai Gurry, research lead of the Cybersecurity Research Labs. Quote, even if you remove your computer's microphone, if you use headphones, you can be recorded. That's why I never speak when I'm near my computer. Wait, except every Wednesday when I'm on Skype or whatever. No, anyways.
I had an interesting virus that I encountered this week that was, I had one of my users called, you know, put in a ticket, and every time someone would try to Skype with him or he would do anything that was related to microphone input where he'd talk, whether it was the speaker on the computer or a headset or whatever, as soon as the call was initiated, it would mute. So something took over and just muted his microphone and speakers. And I dug through every setting I could find trying to figure out what was going on. And I reached out to some coworkers and somebody said, yeah, I'd seen a virus that did that. So I ran and it was presenting no other behavior that was virus related. And I scanned it and I don't remember the name of the Trojan, but there were two Trojans on it.
Interesting.
And when I removed the Trojans, everything came back to working the way it should. So I don't know what the purpose of a Trojan that mutes your microphone is, unless it's a...
Certainly is annoying.
It's the
until you found out that the problem arose right after his staff gave him an electronic birthday card.
Well, what I was wondering is if the virus was maybe a proof of concept or a test to turn on a microphone. Because obviously, if the virus has the ability to mute your mic, or you know, there could be a virus that has the ability to activate the mic. And the only reason we even knew that it was a mic muting thing on this one is that there was there's an actual mute light on the laptop. This brand of this model laptop has a mute light when things are muted, and so you know, like much like the light that comes on when your camera is on, and so it wasn't able to bypass any of that information, but it would be interesting if the virus also could just enable the mic and transfer, you know, whatever's being discussed on the computer to some server somewhere.
You wonder how the virus is out there, how did they know that it had done the job, you know what I mean, with the proof of concept?
Well, I mean, if there may have been another component
for it to get reported on, and then they know that it's,
or maybe there's another component in there that sends us, you know, that talks over the internet about, hey, I've completed my mission, may I come home now?
please tell me that one of the security research firms that looks into these things and names them at least one of them named this Trojan drop the mic.
No, Magic Mike. I don't know what it was called. I wish I'd have made a note of it, but it was so unusual because you don't think about, I mean, people do. You talk about the taping over of cameras and stuff, but there is malware or there is software out there in the wild that can control these things. And that it's not a far, I've also seen them that will actually play music, like some kind of streaming audio onto your computer. So these things have the ability to talk to the internet, obviously send information back. So it could report, you know, simple yes or no, that it's muted, you know, that it's had this trigger effect. And it's also possible that if it was something that was designed to record, that, you know, an audio feed could be sent back, a low bit audio feed, and you wouldn't even know it.
Here's the interesting part. The Ben-Gurion researchers took the hack a step further. Their malware uses a little-known feature of Realtek audio codec chips to silently retask the computer's output channel as an input channel, allowing the malware to record audio even when the headphones remain connected in an output-only jack and don't even have a microphone channel on their plug. The researchers said the Realtek chips are so common that the attack works on practically any desktop computer, Windows or Mac OS, and most laptops too. Realtek didn't immediately respond to Wired's request for comment on the Ben-Gurion researchers' work. Quote, this is a real vulnerability, says Gorey. It's what makes almost every computer today vulnerable to this type of attack. So, of course, you know, they say here that, the eavesdropping attack should only matter to those who have already gone a few steps down the rabbit hole of obsessive counterintelligence measures. But in the modern age of cybersecurity, fears of having your computer's mic surreptitiously activated by stealthy malware are increasingly mainstream. Yeah, I'm betting that gets on next season of Mr. Robot.
So we missed it here, but we had the Presidential Medal of Freedom award going to computer science people, but there will not be a presidential pardon going to Snowden, more or less.
Right.
Yeah, Obama got in front of, I guess he was doing an interview with Der Spiegel a day or two ago, and they asked him about a few different things. He danced around a few different things, and they asked him point blank, hey, will you pardon Snowden? And while he didn't say no, he said pretty much, you know, I can't even consider that, because for me to pardon someone, and I don't know how true or legal this is, they have to come home, stand trial, be found guilty, and then only then can you truly pardon someone of a crime. But there's nothing to pardon right now. I don't know about that.
I just remember that they had where you can kind of, yeah, you can pardon them for any crime they may have committed.
Then how does,
or
then
the
how
past.
Does he pardon
the
Thanksgiving turkey?
That's what I want to know.
The precedent, the serious precedent, Thanksgiving turkey aside, was Gerald Ford issuing a pardon to Richard Nixon in toto, essentially, before any charges were filed and before there was any kind of crime.
Okay, so
that
he
was,
said
that was filed.
He said, quote, I can't pardon someone who hasn't gone before a court and presented themselves. That's not something that I would comment on at this point.
It's incorrect.
Mr. Snowden has raised some legitimate concerns. How he did it was something that did not follow the procedures and practices of our intelligence community. If everybody took that approach, that I make my own decisions about these issues, then it'd be very hard to have an organized government or any kind of national security system. But yeah, he leads out. He said he can't pardon someone who hasn't gone before
so
a court.
That's incorrect.
So
that's a true statement.
Listen,
but it's kind of a red herring. Like,
because
what Snowden did wasn't like, oh, everybody's going to just do whatever they want. Like, what he did was something very important based on a system that was broken. It wasn't just like, oh, I think I'm just going to do whatever I want, just like everybody else can do whatever they want.
But then Obama said, if Snowden ever bumped into me, then I could pardon him.
But I'm
pardon me.
That's what I'm going to miss the most. Mm-hmm. The bad jokes and the thanks Obama memes.
The Thanks Obama memes have gotten really serious. There is a Thanks Obama subreddit, and they've been posting, like, actually for real serious pictures of, like, thanks Obama. Like, gonna miss you. Thanks, Obama. Like,
oh, it's even brought back older memes than that. There was the Miss Me Yet picture of George W. Bush.
Yeah.
And it had a list of years since he left office, and it was no. Yes.
And then there's the other one, the Dancing Biden.
The Dancing Biden?
No, I tell you what I'm going to miss about
bringing, bringing old memes back.
Oh, yeah.
I tell you what I'm going to miss about Joe Biden is I'm going to miss the Onion's coverage of crazy Uncle Joe Biden.
Washing his Camaro
washing
in front of the White House.
It's a Trans Am in the White House Rose Garden. And
the Biden-Obama memes where they're putting the dialogue on the stock photos of Biden and Obama in the White House. There's like, you know, it's like...
Those are awesome.
I'm not going to give him the Wi-Fi password.
No, you're not going to loosen all the screws on the chair.
The one from 6 days ago was Biden forges president's signature on executive order to make December Dokken History Month.
Is he wearing a Dokken shirt?
No, he's wearing a Aussie Howl at the Moon or Bark at the Moon t-shirt. Ozzy Osbourne, Bark at the Moon. Good look. It's a good t-shirt. You've seen that on people before.
Yeah. People wear shirts.
Jay probably,
all the time.
Jay probably,
I know, right?
Jay probably wore that shirt.
And he's got a can of Ice House beer on the resolution desk.
So, yeah, Snowden, it looks like Trump said a couple years ago that he thinks that Snowden should be treated like a traitor and said, like, you know what we used to do with traitors, which more or less was, you know, saying, like, hey, we're going to kill him.
Send him to Gulag. Oh, wait, he is
oh, wait,
Russia.
Hold on.
Likes him,
yeah,
so
but
how does that...
He's going to be confused now because Putin likes him.
Yeah, he's going to buddy up with... Yeah.
You know, the whole right wing has totally embraced Assange now. WikiLeaks, so why not? They should totally embrace
what?
That.
Right wing likes Assange now?
I mean,
well, just because he was releasing all WikiLeaks. The
yeah. If you listen, DNC, I mean, you know. It was just crazy to listen to. I mean, every once in a while, I torture myself by listening to Sean Hannity on the way home, and he had Assange on the show, and they were praising him, and then one of the other guests was from the Weekly World News with some story. I mean, they just embraced all that crazy.
Wow.
Just all that crazy.
Bad boy predicts. But... oh, my. Well, another. So basically, if you want to be super ultra extra paranoid, don't plug your headphones in either. The last thing
that's
on that
how
article
they get you.
Is apparently though
that's
that that ability to change the setting on the Realtek chip, that is not a bug. That is not a mistake. That is a feature that is intentionally there that they found and accessed. So
you
it's
wonder
not
if
just a mess up.
That's not a piece of like the NSA toolkit already. You know, like with a lot of other things that have
been
out there.
Yeah.
Or hasn't been forever. You know, just because that looks very intentional. Looks like, you know, surely someone's using that.
Gotta wonder.
All that Enemy of the State stuff that looks so ridiculous, you know, the Will Smith movie with Gene Hackman, all that stuff looks so ridiculous at the time. And again, it's probably, you know, not the best execution of it, but all those capabilities are, those were real, you know, pretty much.
Yeah, I'm sure the, I don't know, some of this stuff, by the time they get to observing you that closely, I have a feeling there's, like, teams of people and all this technology, you know, there's, it's sort of triple layer. Because the biggest problem is what? Finding people. You know, you think about, like, top terrorism targets, figuring out where they are in the first place is a bigger problem. And they're not going to do, and I guess this is sort of like a version of that, what was it in one of the Batman movies? Remember where they hacked the cell phones?
Bat kind of, yeah. What was that called? They did like some kind of, it was sonar more or less, wasn't it?
Because they were looking for, looking for something. Anyways, but it doesn't take, although there's also kind of the, you know, the average person sitting at home with their headphones connected to their computer, I think you can rely on if you're, you know, that you're probably too boring to really be.
What doesn't matter because they've got nothing to hide.
Hey,
yeah, what are you worried about?
I just got an email from the NSA. It said, "Please stop singing."
Well, the fear here isn't that, you know, they're going to come after any one of us, but that just that, you know, if we let these things exist and they, you know, they continue to be propped up either by governments or by the vendors that do it, it won't be that long until, you know, like your average next-gen hacker, your average 14-year-old can actually get into that kind of stuff.
That's
where
true.
We, you know, Kiesker, all that kind of stuff. You let the good guys in, sooner or later, the marginal and the bad guys are going to get into, it seems.
Or use it for their own purposes,
yeah.
Too. Yeah. Well, here's one. Well, so
pretty soon it's goatsy everywhere.
So then,
no.
So, you know, you're tired of all this hacking stuff, and you want to go see some, I don't know, a concert or sports or something. You know, go to Madison Square Garden. Oops! The Madison Square Garden company just disclosed that someone had access to its payment processing system for almost a year. Well, that's only going to affect, 20, 30 people because, you know, there's just small groups passing through Madison Square Garden in an entire year. All data included on the magnetic strip of your credit card, like credit card numbers, cardholder names, expiration dates, internal verification codes, could have been stolen. It not only affects Madison Square Garden, but also the company's other venues. The theater at Madison Square Garden, Radio City Music Hall, the Beacon Theater, and Chicago Theater. So if you use a credit card at any of these venues to buy merchandise, booze, or overpriced food between November 9th, 2015 and October 24th of this year, you may want to check your bank statement for anything out of the ordinary. They said they've put a stop to the incident. According to the company's statement, it appears the card data wasn't stolen by a physical skimmer placed over the card slot. The company says it found external unauthorized access to MSG's payment processing system and the installation of a program that looked for payment card data as that data was being routed through the system for authorization. This is essentially a virtual skimmer that steals your credit card data as it is entered into the garden's database. Isn't that nice? The thing that sucks about virtual skimmers is that there's really nothing you can do to protect yourself from it. If you suspect a point-of-sale system to have a physical skimmer attached to it, you can always try giving it a tug to see if anything that's not supposed to be there pops off. But in a virtual one, you can't do much except monitor your bank balance for anything suspicious. Virtual skimmers are simply just a harsh reality of our digital world. But don't let that stop you from catching a Knicks game or a Taylor Swift concert or going to any of these other venues. I guess that would be a positive for some of these. I would assume they can't really get any useful data if you used like Apple Pay or Google's method because it's not passing your credit card data. That's not handled at their end. That's resolved at a deeper layer. That if they hack, If they hack at that layer, well, you're pretty much just screwed if you use your card anywhere, you know?
Don't.
So there's that. And then this one, back to a political one. There's been some articles that you may have seen. Obviously, the election, there are several states that were very close, that were within 1% between the two candidates. I believe like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And so, you know, actually when any candidate loses a close election, it's pretty common for his or her supporters to come up with some reason why the election was, quote, stolen. It happened for Democrats after John Kerry lost the 2004 presidential race. It happened for Republicans after Norm Coleman lost a 2008 Senate race in Minnesota. It's happening again for Republicans now that Pat McCrory appears to have lost in North Carolina. So when you read, there's a report in New York Magazine that, quote, a group of prominent computer scientists and election lawyers is urging Hillary Clinton's campaign to request recounts because they believe, quote, they found persuasive evidence that results in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania may have been manipulated or hacked, unquote, in Donald Trump's favor. Well, then you should take a deep breath and look at the evidence that's actually presented. That's why I chose this particular article, because there's a number of articles that say there's people who say there's persuasive evidence. The problem, you know, the thing that one should do, especially in these days of post-truth and fake articles and that, is what is the actual proof? Because it's one thing to allege, oh, you know, yeah, I got huge proof, big league proof. That's not enough. Vox looked into it and found that, unfortunately, if you were hoping it was a fix, there's not much proof. In fact, there's a grand total of one specific claim from the analysis pointed in that New York Magazine piece, sourced to an anonymous person briefed on a recent call, says that the academics presented findings showing that in Wisconsin, Clinton received 7% fewer votes in counties that relied on electronic voting machines compared with counties that used optical scanners and paper ballots. Based on this statistical analysis, Clinton may have been denied as many as 30,000 votes. She lost Wisconsin by 27,000. So that could flip it. The problem with that is that, like according to Nate Silver, the demographics don't fit. You know, the idea, yeah, you could pick counties from around a state. And just the problem is that correlation is not causation. So having paper ballots doesn't mean that Hillary Clinton got more votes in those places, and vice versa. It doesn't mean that there was a fix was in on those others.
Well, Nate Silver's looking at it too, and I mean the evidence is not there. I mean they're able to explain the discrepancies through non-fraud. Causes, but what, here's something interesting though in that story is that Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, has a fundraiser going right now to audit those three states to do a recount, and the goal is $2,500,000 that she's trying to raise to, because that's how much it's going to cost to audit. And I've been watching it online on the fundraiser. And they're up to $1,481,000. It jumps up by about anywhere from about 10 to 100,000 every couple of minutes. So it's receiving wow. attention. I don't. I think it's a silver bullet. It's not going to be a silver bullet. It's not going to yield the results that people may want. But it's interesting.
And I the thing, and this leads into the next article. There's another article that has on Medium that where one of the computer scientists says that that he doesn't think that he doesn't think that the difference between pre-election polls and the results were the result of a cyber attack, but he argues that since hacking is possible, it's simply prudent to conduct a recount in close states where there is a paper trail, which is a reasonable enough thing.
Yeah, that was interesting because I saw people on Facebook mentioning the New York Times article, and then I went to the Washington Post article, and the Washington Post was complaining about the New York, was it the New York? It was the New York Times, right?
New York Mag.
New York Mag. Okay, the New York Mag article they were complaining that they cherry-picked some quotes and data to make it look like something it shouldn't be. But then I usually, a lot of times I don't like to read the comments, but I was reading the comments. A lot of them were horrible, but there was a couple that were really good, and a guy was like, okay, I'm really annoyed at you because you cherry-picked the quote, because he only included the part of the quote from the computer science where he said, I don't think that this deserves a recount. I think it can be explained. And he cut off the rest of the quote, which that guy then inserted, which is where he went on to say, but the fact that hacking is possible and this is an anomaly that, you know, it could be because of hacking, then we probably should go ahead and research it just to rule that out. And, you know, he left that part off. So it was interesting watching that go back and forth. But actually, one of the quotes I enjoyed the most was, isn't it funny how before the election, the people on the Republican side were like really, really flipping out about how
it's
the
rigged.
Election's rigged. When we lose, we're going to like, you know, have, you know, recounts and all this stuff. And the Democrat side basically were like, no, that's not the way it works. It's all distributed. There's no problems. Everything's good. It all works out in the end. Y'all need to just get over it. And then the election results came in, and all of a sudden, you know, the Democrats are the ones that are like, man, we need to recount this. Something, this is not right. It was rigged.
Yeah, and the Republicans are all, no, it yeah. was pure as
no,
driven this snow.
Is,
there
yeah,
was nothing
yeah,
happening.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
These.
It's a complete flip from what was going on before the election actually took place.
You and think then, there's hypocrisy?
You think?
Well, I don't know. Just to be fair, the Republicans were saying the only circumstance where it's rigged is if they lose. So they were, so they're not being so hypocritical because they were already, you know, they were already pre-setting it to where, of course, then if they did win, that means it's not rigged. But
well,
no, there, so
if they were right, then I guess it all worked out.
So they're not hypocrites, yay! But then Wired has an article that talks about the whole, you know, what we just talked about as far as the, you know, some question about, you know, this doesn't have the fingerprints of hacking, but, you know, I think that maybe, but then they bring up the better point, which is why we should be able to, and we should be auditing every election every time, and the reason should be that both sides or all sides of the election should be able
Can't
to look
be
back
trusted.
At it and know that it's and that would that's even-handed and fair. I think the biggest problem is that a lot of places cheaped out on how they've done it and the way voting systems are set up, that there really is no legitimate audit method because, oh, well, the machine, you know, every time I push the button, it tells me to give the total.
I looked in the Microsoft Excel spreadsheet, and then that's what the numbers are. So, yep, yeah. It's audited. It's correct.
Gave me the right number every time, except the time when the ancient Windows XP this machine runs on blue screened me, but then that was other than that.
But, you know, the tides really turned in the voting after that happened, but, you know, that's just the way it is.
You know, it seems this gets back to it ties in sort of with that whole kind of securing the Internet of Things. It's like, you know what? We need to secure things. Everything needs to be secured. We need to find ways where it can be secure and where you can be comfortable knowing that knowing whether your vote actually counted and whether there was a problem. Now, we all take it on, you know, presumably right now we're all taking it on faith that we haven't had an election that's been turned by hacking or any of those kinds of things. But, you know, some things it seems like it, like the paper trail thing, it would certainly be nice to have a paper trail. You know, that there's a printout. You almost, and I am not the smart person or even close to smart enough to figure it out, but it seems like there should be a way where you would be able to verify, you know, that you would get like a serial number or something that you could then use that would verify that your vote, you know, where your vote went in, that you could do that for yourself. And that, but no one else would be able to check it, and they would not really be able to use that. You know, the big problem, you know, like some people have said, well, what if you got like a receipt so you could see what you, the reason they don't let you keep those is because back in the day when they had crooked elections, you know, which the U.S. had plenty of those, vote buying. If you could come out and prove that you voted for, hey, if you can come out and prove to me you voted for Joe Schmo, I'll give you a beer. And that was enough. And so they that's why you don't, that's the states that have laws about not taking a selfie with your ballot or taking a picture of your ballot. That's so that's to try and, you know, it's one of those where they don't explain that. It's just, no, it's against law. Well, no, the deal is they don't want people to be able to sell their vote, because obviously if they could prove that they voted one way or another, then, you know, and then there'd be, of course, be the smart kid who knows to, like, take the picture of voting for candidate A in the first part when you're going through and checking them the first time, and then take the picture, and then change your vote to candidate B, and take the picture
times.
And go get the money from both the idiots. But
hey, voting paid, more people would vote again.
So, you know, it seems to, I don't know, it seems to me it's like maybe something that printed out a receipt that showed who you voted for, that you then had to put in a lockbox or whatever so that it could be checked. It is, you know, I trust computers, I use them all the time, but there's a certain point where, you know, when you want to validate that kind of stuff. And also, you know, another thing I wonder about, the kind of centralized tabulation stuff where all the votes go into one big central place. You kind of go, okay, as a computer person who's looking at where would I want to hack? Mm-hmm. Do I want to hack the, you know, the stupid part is there's all this focus on single votes. Mm-hmm. Oh, dead people are going and voting. Well, you know, that is really an inefficient, if you're going to try and steal an election, having 50 people show up from the graveyard, unless it's a town of 75, you're kind of not going to swing the election one way or the other. If you're going to swing an election, you want to get the tabulators. You want to change
an army of darkness of dead people.
You want to hit people would kind of notice them showing up to go vote, you know, to vote whatever way you're instructed.
Age demographics, the 120-year-old vote really, really turned out today. That's excellent.
And but so the place where you would want to hack it is where it totals up.
Well, it used to be really tough because up until just a handful of years ago, there wasn't a really good place to, because if you think about counting paper votes and someone's going to, you know, come in and steal votes or come in and actually manually change votes, it's kind of the same issue with storing those votes on a computer system, because you've got to trust the computer system enough to where, you know, no one's come in. You've got to have audit trails. You've got to have all these security measures in place that are really, honestly, almost impossible to protect. But the cool thing is that, like, some of the technologies that have come out the last handfuls of years, like Bitcoin, for instance, blockchain, yeah, does a really, really good job of making information, a record of information, immutable while preserving that record and letting you tell exactly what's going on where everyone can see it without rendering who did what vote. And there's, you know, there's a big movement to say, like, hey, let's bring blockchain technology into the voting, you know, booth and leverage some of those technologies. So it might get there. But whereas I would not have trusted, like, if someone had, if someone had a big online database out there saying, hey, here's everyone's vote in America, oh my, I would not want that to be out there, because, you know, that's a huge target.
Right.
I think with this kind of technology, if you do it at a grassroots level and all those blockchains are kept and you can tell what we've lost, what we have, they all go together, I think that gets us in the direction where we need to be, because it's got accountability. It's got some things that, you know, that just the digital side didn't have until, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, and you can count. And if you attempt to manipulate it, there's fingerprints and there's places to, mm-hmm, to, mm-hmm, determine that. Because the best, it's one of those, the best time to really get people focused on it, and again, the problem is, the losers care about auditing the election. The winners, who are taking office and power and so on, not so much. They're fine with it as is. They don't want to find out if there was a problem. But, you know, it does, it seems like, the authoritarian types, the guys who, you know, win 95% of the election, you know, they're only worried if they win 95% instead of 94%. They win 94% instead of 95%. What went wrong? My vote counter. How did you get this wrong? You know, they're not worried about the integrity of the vote because they already, you know,
they want a
wasn't
they want a
there
mandate
in the first place. there was no integrity of the vote. But as a democracy, we're clearly vulnerable to that. Or a republic. I know the people. Not a democracy. Well, your votes.
In our capitalist republic,
it should be that we, you know, and in the past, it's always been. In the past, it's always been the DMCA thing where, oh, no, you can't see our source code. You know, that's a private, that's secret. And then you have the guys who can walk into a booth and hack the machine in 5 minutes. You know, they've demonstrated it. You know, there's the openness. Is it's like, you know what, about 6 months before the election, I'm thinking they should have, I would love to see, I'd like to see an array of voting machines at DEF CON and tell us who passed and who we shouldn't be voting on, kind of thing, because it makes sense, and you know, it's like the self-driving car. We can get 100 articles about how, oh well, that better be safe, and what happens if it has to choose between protecting the driver and protecting the pedestrians, and all those they come up with all those questions, but when it comes down to voting, everybody just goes, what? You know, it's like everybody turns into a Bond villain. Oh, I've locked the door. They're handcuffed. We take it as a given. He's gone. The Bond is destroyed.
And we probably even don't want to get anywhere near this. And I know we've got like 9 minutes in the last part of the hour, so that's probably good. But we've also got the technology, probably for the first time ever, to have more of a direct democracy kind of scenario. Because before, voting, you know, I think a lot of the reason, and this is me probably getting way out of what I'm not, I don't know what I'm talking about anymore. But I did read a couple books way back in the day.
Everybody dials a phone number? Most votes.
Well, not so much now.
No, the candidates are on Twitter until one of them cries or quits.
Well, a lot of the issues were, you know, back when you had election season and stuff like that, not everyone could leave the farm and go ride for 3 days to go cast their vote. So you had the Senate. You even look at, like, how Rome did it. You had this, you know, it was prompt by proxy vote. Like, hey, what do you guys want to vote? I will go represent us. I will go cast that vote because we can't all leave the farm. We can't all walk that far. There are responsibilities here. We don't have to hike for 2 days or you ride a horse for a day and have to go cast a vote. We could, you know, cryptographically cast one online. So I know, like, some countries, I think Sweden's moved to direct democracy. A couple other countries have. But, you know, one of those barriers to us, you know, one vote, you know, counts as one vote, is that tech, and now that's been broken down. So who knows what's going to happen, but slowly, you know, we're evolving into a new model where we don't have to vote the way we've voted for the last 200 years.
And it would be that, and it's good to see somebody trying that, because you think about it, again, the technology is getting there to where you can have that kind of vote of the populace and find out what they think. The problem you get into, though, is what I call the pizza ordering problem, which is if you have too direct a democracy where everybody has got input and you're trying to decide,
well, that's, I mean,
then
that's,
it's very hard to make.
That's one of the purposes of the Electoral College, is to protect against the tyranny of the majority and to help represent the less populous
states.
Sure
worked this last time, didn't it?
And representative democracy. Obviously, you have the pyramid of people making decisions at their levels.
I'm not attempting to defend or whatever. I'm just saying that is one of the stated purposes of the Electoral College is to.
It does appear to have represented the rural. Populous.
And again,
at a higher peak.
That is a designed output.
Ignoring numbers, though, or not ignoring the numbers, you know, looking at it, it is a symptom of a problem when the candidate that wins by a real percentage, I'm thinking it's 1-point-some-odd percent or 2%, that the outcome by the Electoral College method and the outcome by the majority vote method, when those get too far apart, most of the time it's pretty well matched, and so nobody has a problem or question with it. But when you do start getting where it doesn't seem to be, you know, there's the majority rule, and that is supposed to protect less populous states. But then you also get into the problem of, well, I think France learned what happened when you don't protect, when the majority doesn't feel like it's protected or that it's.
I mean, yes and no. This is
open the door.
This is a valid. I mean, it's a valid thing to discuss, and it gets into the nature of representative democracy, and you know, this is definitely not for Technology Bites. This is not our show.
It's for the next show.
I mean, seriously, the tyranny of the majority is a real thing, and majority vote isn't necessarily an indication of, and I'm not saying this in the context of the election, this is in a vacuum, a majority vote is not necessarily an indication that it is whatever is being voted on is a wise decision or a wise action taken. And that is one of the reasons for the existence of the Electoral College. Yeah, now, whether or not that applies here or not, yes.
When was the last time any delegate actually went against what they were supposed to go vote for? I mean, this has
it
been
happens.
Like...
There's sometimes, but it's it very happens. Rare.
It's mm-hmm. very rare.
Although the thing, you know, the point Barrett was raising about direct democracy, though, you know, the thing, the piece to that, you know, obviously the technology that enables it, I'm interested in that. But also, if you know that, if you can essentially imagine if you could really poll the electorate
mm-hmm.
and get an answer where you know that, you know how many of them actually responded and some of that, you could really get a feel for what does the nation think, or at least what does the majority think, and even, you know, substantial minorities,
mm-hmm.
you would have that information where right now representative rule is built around the idea that, well, you know, if he's off base is when he goes back to his, you know, when he goes back to his district, they'll let him know kind of
that
thing.
That doesn't work either.
And
that
comes down to kind of gut feel and stuff. But
it doesn't work.
It seems like it would be, you know, obviously we don't want government by like, you know, like Family Feud. And now the decisions will we go to war? Survey says, ding.
It's like America's Got Talent. It's like America's Got Vote.
Yeah, my argument here is that if people, the powers that be, when it comes time to rethink how elections work, we have options that are available to us now that were not there when we first set this thing up. You know,
right.
I say we, I mean, you know, us as a nation a couple hundred years ago, but it's, you know, we've got the technology now.
Oh, well, actually, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune.
I do think, you know, Watery? Yeah, I'm going to say this incorrectly, but we should maybe look at new systems of government.
Just being swords.
Actually, maybe a solid basis for a system of government. We should look at that, too.
Hell,
rises from the mandate from the masses.
Oh, and links to all this, you know, as we come up on the
forum.
king.
How do you get to be king then?
I did.
You can find all these articles that we've been talking about at geekradio.com.
All right. Well, that music tells us that it's time to take a break. We hope you've enjoyed the first hour of Technology Bites, and we'll stick around for hour two of Technology Bites. We have a rare in-studio appearance by Peter Hughes, and we are Groovehouse free. So it's an exciting night for everyone. We'll be right back after these messages. You are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And I'm Lee.
He sure is. Westworld coming up next.
How does one get to become king?
Giving Tuesday is the Tuesday following Thanksgiving Day, and this year that means it falls on November 29th. This is a nationally focused philanthropic campaign to encourage support for worthy organizations that rely on financial donations from generous people like you, as KPFT Pacifica Radio in Houston does most certainly. On Giving Tuesday, as you consider your year-end giving, please remember your one and only community radio station, KPFT. You can make a contribution securely online at kpft.org, or you can drop us a gift to 419 Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas 77006. The continued consolidation of the media make your support of KPFT more important than ever. Please help keep this expression of free speech alive by going to kpft.org to help. This is KPFT Houston.
K
KPFT, in partnership with many of our restaurant friends, has initiated the KPFT Foodie Card. KPFT members will get this card sent to them with each donation, or you can pick one up at the station. Present the card when you dine out at any of our participating restaurants, such as Pat Greer's Kitchen, Myth Cafe, Berry Hill in the Heights, and more, to receive special discounts. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
I like to eat, 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 apples and bananas. I like to eat, 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 apples and bananas.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We now return to Technology Bites, already in progress.
And that's the way that we know the Earth to be banana shaped.
This new learning fascinates me.
Tell me again.
How do you know she's a witch? If she weighs as much as a duck.
Okay, here's my pet peeve about quoting Monty Python.
Well, we did do the dress. And the nose. She has got a wart.
Quoting things like Monty Python on your Facebook or the Twitters, you can really separate the wheat from the chaff on how people respond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people respond with, like, you know, the most there's the quote that's the obviously, you know, the top level quotes that everybody knows, you know, like your mother smelled of elderberry.
Pull the what? Other one.
Duck. Yeah, I thought we were just having a nice little conversation about Monty Python right here. You had to bring.
Well, I was just talking about how. Huh?
That's what
you
I
gotta
love.
Bring my
the
mom
earnest,
into it?
The earnest comments that take your quotes seriously and well, that's not really.
That's not what right for my particular. my particular.
Idiom, sir.
I'm
idiom.
No, you came here for an argument.
Scarcely was his armor damp.
No, but the more obtuse or obsequious the quotes are, the better I like them, you know. But there's the people that feel, you know, that they have to jump in there with the obvious quote to show that, you know, what you're talking about. So just a pet
I recognize that as Monty Python. Let me demonstrate that.
Let's act-knack Monty Python.
Just a simple knee is all you really need. You know, there's to be a like, dislike, and a knee. Facebook needs to bring in just like knee. Just recognize as Monty Python. And then
knights, you say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, mate, this bird wouldn't foam if you put 4 million volts through it.
Well, is it Siri or Alexa that can answer the question on the unlabeled?
Alexa does. Siri probably does, too. Really, any AI or digital assistant at this point, if they don't do that, they don't have a place in assistant.
Then they weren't made by real geeks.
Because Python is an integral part of the Turing test. Quoting Python?
It's probably written in
large.
Python.
Number 7.
Siri may have some large. Python roots in there.
All right, so just to give you a Jill Stein election count update.
Is she winning yet?
I mean, I think she's trying to make up for the fact that the number of people that voted for her is probably what cost Clinton the election.
Isn't she also an anti-vaxxer?
She's all kinds of crazy, but I think everybody's all for her right now, including George Takei. On this recount.
I don't like the anti-vax stuff. I think that vax is a perfectly fine operating system. It's old, it's crusty. I like the fact that every time you do a file, it would version it for you.
I don't remember how to do anything on it, but, man, I used to use the heck out of
Jetson,
vax VMS
wasn't,
systems.
Wasn't a Jetson
was
a vax
U of H.
cluster at U of H?
Yeah,
that
it was all.
Oh, I remember.
First and last account was on Jetson as far as vax.
I had a Jetson account.
Yeah, it was all at U of
Digital.
H.
I never used.
I was at A&M, so we had, the engineering department had Sigma, Summa, and Magna. And then the regular ones were Venus, Star, Rigel. I'm blanking on one. Anyway, those
didn't
are the back systems at
don't
A&M.
We have Windows NT primarily based off of the VMS VMS kernel?
A little bit. Yeah. So right? DEC Digital Equipment, which used to have a nice little office right off 290, which then merged with Compaq a while ago, they were the ones that made VAX in the 70s.
We had a lot of when I first joined up at Boeing in 2001. We had a ton of VMS, I don't think it was VAX, but we had a bunch of big digital and DEC racks in the data center in the 9114 building, and we had a guy. His name's Scott Thompson, still works in Houston, although he doesn't work at Boeing anymore, and he had a license plate that I still remember. He still has it on his car. It said VMS Man.
I actually worked on, professionally worked on digital Unix systems. So they weren't VMS. You know, this was kind of post VMS. There were still some hanging on that people still use, but for the most part, most VAX VMS systems were gone at this point. It was the mid late 90s, but they were like DEC digital workstations that were running Unix that I worked on.
How did that make you feel?
They were okay, but what I really enjoyed was every once in a while I get to hop onto a Cray and run stuff on a Cray. That was cool.
Where you were
running? COS, was it? What was the
operating system for Cray?
I think it was
Space Adventure.
Krayos.
I think it was called COS. Hold on. Now everybody's frantically
spend your time
Googling.
Racking your brain to find something that would go slowly.
Unicos.
Unicos was the successor to the Cray operating system.
Yeah, either COS or Unicos. Yeah.
Which is COS.
Which I'm sure were System 5 Unices. So what does it say here? You say System 5 Unix, or do you say System V?
It's technically 5, but I say SysV.
SysV.
Which is weird, but it's 5.
Yeah, I think if I say it all out, I say System 5, but if I shorten it, I would say SysV.
I always wanted to have an old Cray as a bench in a room. You know,
just a, you know. Yeah, actually, I know some places they said that people actually put signs on them that said, do not sit, because they look like very postmodern circular
you'd find
benches.
A hotel lobby. I really want one just for that purpose.
I want one. You know, like there were some places in Vegas where they had those kind of like around a podium seating. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yeah, I want one. I don't want one that looks like a Cray. I want an actual Cray, elevated, modified.
So in the winter you can turn it on and the seat will be warm.
So this is yes. Interesting. If you're a dork,
if you're a dork,
that's us. Unicos, the Cray operating system that was the successor to COS, was indeed a System 5 Unix, was based around System 5 Release 2, but the original Cray operating system was not a Unix-like operating system.
Cray-op.
It was written by Control Data.
Was it Cray-op?
No, just Cray operating system. Succeeded the
if
Chippewa
it's not Unix,
operating
it's Cray-op.
System. I see what you did there. But yeah, no, not a Unix. Custom operating system written by ex-CDC employees, fascinatingly enough. Control Data Systems, not the CDC.
So this was a successor to the totally handwritten Crayola.
So Unix Unix space system space V is pronounced System 5, but it's very, very frequently abbreviated S like SYSV, SysV.
Yeah,
so it's both are correct. I like it when two views of the world can coexist.
I love it when a plan comes together.
Like VI and Emacs.
Yeah. What?
That was a couple weeks ago.
Tricked you into it.
Well, I can run VI within Emacs. So I agree with you. Yeah.
Everybody needs to try my new operating.
Because VI is efficient enough to do that.
Everybody needs to try my new operating system, RM-FR. It's installed already on most of your computers.
It just says access denied.
Sudo.
Need to try my version, sudo RMRF. I'm sorry, I say sudo. I can't help it, even though you're not supposed to.
I hear a team.
I acknowledge that is a team.
I pity the fool.
I need to slip you some milk so we can take you on a plane, Jay.
That was a reference.
References.
All right, well, I'm thinking maybe...
We are totally off script.
Maybe I need to turn on... Yeah, see, that way it's just postmodern and you catch the end and know what it is. No, that's Bite of the Apple, and I had my speakers off because that's a wise thing to do when one is in the studio, but, of course, makes it hard to...
No actual apples were harmed.
And trigger warning... Trigger warning for politics again. No, this one just was odd. So this is an Apple story. In a recent interview with the New York Times, President-elect Donald Trump said he received phone calls from Apple CEO Tim Cook and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates after winning the presidential election earlier this month. Trump told Cook it will be, quote, a real achievement, unquote, for him when he gets Apple to make its products in the United States, as opposed to countries like China and Vietnam, where many of its current manufacturing partners operate. It says, quote, and I know I do not do a Trump impersonation.
He said, especially your desktops. That'll be a big win, real big win. Because they're already made in Texas.
Yeah, the Mac Pro. Oh, no, Cook probably said, You know what? You're right. I'm going to make desktop computers in Texas now, starting today.
Well, no, that was a whole news story. I mean, where he said that Ford told him they were no longer going to move the plant to Mexico, that they never intended to move to Mexico in the first place. So Trump claimed that as a victory.
I kept the White House in Washington, D.C. I did that.
No, he says, I got a call from Tim Cook at Apple, and I said, Tim, you know, one of the things that will be a real achievement for me is when I get Apple to build a big plant in the United States, or many big plants in the United States, where instead of going to China and going to Vietnam and going to the places that you go to, you're making your product right here. Cook acknowledged the proposition by nondescriptly saying, I understand that, which... You know,
as a single bead of sweat rolled down the side of his face.
On the radio, but,
Tim Cook also indicated that he looked forward to going to Pence's reprogramming camps.
Cook said, I'll have Siri get right on that. You can check with your phone. And I don't know if Trump has an iPhone. I believe from his tweeting.
No, it's an Android.
Is it Android?
There's a whole school of people that followed the Twitter out. And figured out that if it's sane, it comes from the iPhone. And if it's like crazy, it comes from the Android. So they can tell who's tweeting on behalf of Trump or if it's Trump tweeting himself. And there's a whole right about the whole week or so leading up to the election. There was report that he had been isolated from his phone, and all the tweets that were coming out were all iPhone, no Android tweets.
So a recent report said Apple asked its Taiwanese manufacturing partner Foxconn to study the possibility of moving iPhone production to the United States, although Foxconn chairman Terry Gao is said to be less than enthusiastic about the idea due to inevitably higher production costs compared to China. I think he said, I understand that, but in Taiwanese perhaps, but no. Anyway, so yeah, I just thought that was interesting given the specific focus on Apple. Apple does have a Mac Pro manufacturing facility in Austin, Texas, operated by Flextronics, but it is a limited effort given the relatively low production volume of its high-end desktop computer. That way you'll know, yeah, that's what Apple will bring back. They'll take huge tax cuts and then bring back, yeah, we're bringing the Apple TV production to Des Moines, Iowa. Yeah, we got 25 people working on those.
I'll be
Apple
bringing
TVs
all of our Palm
buying.
Production back.
Like 30-inch monitors.
Yes.
They cost like $7,000 apiece.
Yeah. Well, that they don't even make anymore, which, you know, by the way, Apple, you know, they don't make monitors anymore. They outsource that to LG.
They'll build
and they're not going to make routers anymore.
They'll build the solid gold Apple watches that are like $17,000
apiece. Maybe the Apple One.
Maybe we do need some tech
subsidies.
The
reason we call it the Apple One watch is that we're only making one.
We got real political tonight. No, maybe we do need like some tech subsidies. Maybe we should protect our tech industry versus protecting, you know, like the price of corn and ethanol that's destroying my motorcycle. You know, my motorcycles one by one over the course of 15 years with all the E10 and E15 fuel. I don't know.
Well, maybe you need to get into the like. Figuring out the chemical that you can put in the gas that will get rid of the...
Doesn't do it.
Sounds like you need a...
stabilizer doesn't actually...
No, I mean something that will actually like remove it or...
Sounds like you need a two-cycle motorcycle.
Or motorcycle. You need hipster...
I got one of those.
You need hipster handmade gasoline.
Well, I like the idea of you
we
bringing...
Artesian gasoline.
We take genuine crude gasoline from the ground.
Craft gasoline.
Aged. I like the idea.
We're gonna rebrand Carbock.
Oh, there we go.
Get it?
Yeah. We'll give you your Carbock.
Here's your Carbock.
I like the idea of like local electronics manufacturing, but to get down to those prices, I mean, we'd almost have to, you know, do subsidies. The government would almost have to pay for every iPhone manufactured just because I don't know how else to. Flextronics is they're awesome. They're solid. I've been out and actually visited.
I've seen
their
a bunch of people
on
Facebook. I think they already do that because, you know, I saw a bunch of people on Facebook saying that, you know, they had Obama phones.
Ah.
Made by Obama himself.
Chin scratching emoji.
So Apple, you know, is there anything Apple can do anymore? They don't do monitors. They don't do now.
So they're going to
they
stop making
routers.
Their routers, the AC.
They,
yes.
I
well,
like,
probably.
No, hold on.
Kudos airport? To the headline yeah. writer yep. at ours. Report: no. Apple is formally abandoning its old, outdated airport routers. Good one.
That was Andrew.
Good one to Andrew Cunningham. Airport engineers have allegedly been reassigned to other projects.
Now, what I'm interested in knowing is whether or not they are also going to abandon Time Capsule, because you have precisely one supported option in the Apple ecosystem for a network backup, and that is an Apple Time Capsule. You can do local backups with Time Machine and attached drives all day long. There's no restriction there. But as far as officially supported network backups, it's Time Capsule only. Now,
well,
there's one go,
other. There's you a, can do Apple Server and hook an external drive, and it will put it will.
That is correct. I'm sorry, Time you are correct. You can do that if you want to pay for the whatever the $19
they don't
Apple
make,
Server.
They
thing.
Don't make Apple servers
no,
anymore.
No, you can just
right?
get the
just
Apple
the
Server
software.
Package.
Yeah,
and it actually, I mean, in its defense, I've used it. Well, I've tested it and then looked at the options. And it actually looks pretty neat. It gives you like a repository for multiple Macs that you can manage centrally. I mean, it looks pretty cool. But not everybody is going to do that, especially not, you know, average casual Mac users. So I mean, what are you going to do with your what are you going to do to do network backups from here on?
Well, and the funny thing is with that Apple servers is that it kind of had the same mentality sort of like Apple like desktops like. Oh, we're going to make it so easy that, you know, it's like everything's intuitive. Except with servers, it's even more complex than desktops as far as functionality and features for server, you know, daemons and stuff. And so, like, trying to do that, it just, I mean, when it worked, it was like a desktop except amplified. Like, when it worked, it was really nice. But when it didn't work, it was really, really horrible.
Now, let me tell you one thing they did excellently well. And this is truly amazing. The shining beacon of amazingness on the Apple server product is Apple Open Directory. Because if you have ever tried to configure Open LDAP and you're still alive, you are a superhuman, amazing, like, pillar of strength. Because I've been down the Open LDAP route before. And I mean, it is like abandon every hope, all you who enter here and try to configure this product, because you will be driven to madness and death. But Apple Open Directory is, I mean, it's not Active Directory, but you know, really, what is? But it is very, very good, and it puts a friendly face on Open LDAP, and it actually works in Open LDAP environments
too. That is true. That one, the GUI layer on top of it, just like with Active Directory,
yeah.
Was pretty nice because I used to run Sun LDAP servers.
I'm sorry.
And yeah, not very fun when you have to go in there and make edits to the schema and stuff.
No, you have to be specialized in that and like immerse yourself in it because it is absolutely baffling. Especially if you just like want to do it as a weekend project at home and be like, wouldn't it be neat if I had network accounts at home like at work? I'll set up Open LDAP. Yeah.
It takes some work. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like I'm just going to throw down a Windows VM and set up Active Directory to play with. That's doable. You sit down and be like, I don't know, maybe I want to mess with Open LDAP. Just slit your wrist now and save yourself the time.
One of the sad parts and one of the things that I think contributed to killing kind of Apple's server thing is there were a number of years. The recent ones are pretty good, but there were a number of years where they kind of
They did what they could with
the GUI.
Yeah.
And then what happened is when anyone who tried to dive into it, I was among the unfortunates who did, you'd end up talking to somebody who had been working on it, you know, longer or had a more continuous experience, and they would, you know, knowingly nod and go, oh yeah, well, you know, you have to do all these other things they don't tell you and that aren't there, or that where you have to go in and do it from a command line.
See, I was working in a Unix shop, but we had a lot of I did Unix side. There's a lot of Windows stuff, but we also had Macs, and we had some spare money one year, and my manager was like, hey, why don't we buy a couple of Xservs and we can play with them? And so this was PowerPC Xservs, so we bought a couple of PowerPC Xservs, and I set them up, and so I admin them, but we weren't running any services off of them or anything for the greater community, right? I didn't run the mail server as a mail server. I didn't run Apple's Open Directory, any of that stuff other than just kind of playing with it. And then we ended up later buying a couple more Xservs when they flipped to Intel. And once again, same thing. Like, they might have been used for a couple of special purposes. Then we had a new head of IT that came in, and he imagined himself to be a Steve Jobs. but he was one of those people who has got the negative aspects of being Steve Jobs without the visionary part. but imagines himself a visionary. Anyway, he was pretty into Apple stuff. So we bought some big Power Macs, Intel Power Macs. And, you know, we're going to set those up and we're going to run all these services on it. I was the closest thing that we had to an Apple admin. And the thing is, like, I'd been using Mac for 10 years at that point, right? But as an end user, I'd admin these, but nobody really used them, right? And, but they didn't get me to be the Apple admin. And so it basically just kind of sat there and all fell apart because, yeah, it's kind of specialized knowledge. And if that's not what you're building your infrastructure on, then it's just doesn't work real well with everything else and how you use it compared to what, you know, what everything else that already exists.
A tough one for me was that the person that was helping me that on it worked in an environment where they were where it was very tight secured, and so the whole thing was tying people's data to just that, to that one person. In other words, so that user account had its narrow swath of what it could do and all that kind of stuff. And I was being asked by the client I was working on this for, no, they wanted, you know, a pool where they're sharing and, you know, it's all cloudy kind of thing.
Apple stuff can get into that sometimes where it just doesn't want to be locked down in order to function properly.
The 80-20 rule really well, but maybe so this not guy as was bad putting as, me through all the stuff he was SGI, doing to lock it down, and it didn't really need it.
Like SGI back in the day was horrible.
IRX with it common was, desktop
it was,
environment.
It was Unix Swiss cheese. Like, I mean, vulnerabilities, root vulnerabilities, remote vulnerabilities all the time, just all over the place.
Anytime you boot up your Unix operating system and CDE loads, you know you're going to have a bad time.
But, I mean, the thing is, it was geared mostly towards graphic designers and stuff, and they were trying to make it very easy, and so everything was kind of GUI driven, and it was just security wasn't a real big concern, I don't think, ever at any point. And, you know, Apple's not that bad, but they still have that same mentality. They want to make it easy for the end user, you know, and so when you do that, you just start losing functionality. You know, you start limiting what can be done unless you go in under the GUI and start messing with stuff, and then it becomes not supported, you know, as easily because it's like non-standard, et cetera.
The ugliest things I've ever seen, some of the ugliest configuration files, regardless, is when you get people hand configuring things where you've got like a GUI overstepping that and seeing those things battle it out. And it just, you never, ever, ever want that.
Yes.
And then you plug in a second monitor and your xorg.conf file.
I would get, I can't remember what that. It wasn't Samba. I can't remember. There was some piece of software that I used to admin, and I would get so annoyed because I would spend all this time like commenting the sections and like separating them out and using certain conventions for spacing. And
Samba would do that, and SWAT would come in and rewrite
it
the
was
Samba
SWAT.
Conf. Yes,
yeah.
The SWAT.
And then you run SWAT,
it
and it or somebody else would
yeah,
run
someone
SWAT,
else would run it.
And suddenly you come back to your config file, and all the comments are gone. Everything's reformatted. It was horrible.
Just don't use Samba. She's NFS.
Just don't use SWAT. Yeah.
Just use NFS.
NFS has like, bugs, believe it or not.
NFS like God intended. You've used NFS before?
No. I've used it. We just installed a very large NAS at work, and this is actually happening.
God, this show is full of acronyms.
While running OpenBSD with NFS mounts, when moving large amounts of data across GigE connections, it borks.
NFS V4?
Mm-hmm. It's well documented now.
NFS is nice if you know if you've got Unix
systems.
We're
talking like 20 gigs or so of movements,
but back in the day, if you had Windows systems, you weren't going
to
do
NFS.
Oh,
I used to have to admin
unless you had to install software that could do NFS on all your Windows machines.
I used to have an admin and EMC Celera NAS in a mixed protocol environment where shares had to be available over NFS and SMB SIF simultaneously, and we had to get into the funky specialized permission stacking
that's horrible. That's horrible.
And we had to do it custom because we had multiple NIST domains, and EMC's easy tools only supported if your NFS was all in a single NIST domain, and we had like 8. So we were doing all these like, it was like every day was like, all right, which share has had its permissions eaten by which group today? Which permissions am I restoring today?
My previous job, we dealt with that. I didn't personally, thankfully, ever have to deal with that, but I had friends that I worked with. Yet every day, every few days when they came in, they were going in and correcting shares where somebody had come in everybody was using one style. Somebody came with another one, and it just like whack the permissions on everything.
Yeah. Oh man, just fun times.
Quick finish to the Apple news, and we're going for. See, we're trying to be more popular, and so we've
popular now.
so first we'll outrage you. Reportedly, Apple is. Here's one for your iPhone 7, so that you can feel vaguely dissatisfied with it and wonder, are you actually dissatisfied or not? If you have a Verizon iPhone 7, reportedly,
yes.
Apple has been limiting the modem speeds of the iPhone 7 that they built for Verizon's wireless networks in order to match the slower speeds of the AT&T iPhone, yes. According to reports Friday by Bloomberg and Recode.
It's Intel versus...
The Verizon iPhone 7 uses a Qualcomm Snapdragon X12 modem that is capable of LTE download speeds of up to 600 megabits per second, while the AT&T model uses an Intel XMM7360 that goes up to 450 megabits per second. But Apple limits the Verizon model so it performs similarly to the AT&T one. To achieve this, Apple may disable certain features of the network chip, according to Bloomberg. Bloomberg's report is based on data from testing firms, including Cellular Insights, which wrote about its findings on its blog. I think, you know, in this one, I would not ascribe malice to Apple on this. I have a feeling the idea is that they don't want they're not picking winners here. They want to sell iPhones to every provider. And, you know, if you think about it, if one had a head and shoulders better setup than the other, people would probably just stay with their current provider and not get an iPhone.
I was reading some stuff because I'm on T-Mobile. So I was reading the T-Mobile subreddit about some stuff because I was trying to figure out some stuff. And I saw somebody posted a speed test from Dallas from a couple days ago. And they got like 250 meg down on their phone, really fast. Yeah. it was somewhere between 220 and 250, and it was like, oh, I broke the 200 barrier, but they broke it a lot. Anyway, in that, people were saying like, oh, you know, what did you do to mod the phone? What were you using? Where were you? Whatever. They were in Dallas, but there were people in that thread saying, well, yeah, that's awesome. I'm gonna go get a phone, but I'm gonna go get the Verizon phone, even though I'm on this other carrier, so that I can get the Qualcomm chip. Because these are people that are looking into speeds and stuff, and so they read. Now they didn't read that Apple was throttling it, right? They just read that
the Qualcomm chip
is faster than Intel, so they were gonna go buy the Verizon iPhone in order to get the Qualcomm chip.
That's, I would just wonder, bad. isn't part of the deal that aren't our or I guess no, there's still the it doesn't lock to Verizon, does it? On the
a lot of
anymore.
I think most of them are unlocked now if you buy them outright.
They're multi mode.
Yeah,
whatever.
and the LTE will use they're both. They're world phones now, so they can do CDMA or GSM.
Let's see. The Verizon model is also used for the Sprint network, while the AT&T model is also used on T-Mobile. The AT&T T-Mobile variant does not support the CDMA voice and data networks used by Verizon and Sprint. I'm guessing that's the reason why they chose the different hardware. So now you can the first question to ask somebody who's griping about that they're not getting, you know, 600 megabits per second down is ask them how fast their home internet connection is. 25 megabits per second. I've been on DSL since the beginning. I get 1.5 megabits down.
Oh, and that also one other thing I noticed then is that who's the big Time Warner, Comcast, whoever. Comcast, that's for Houston. They increased the rates on two of their plans. I don't remember what their dumb plan names are, but they went from like 100 to 125 or 150 and 125 to 150 or 175.
They used to have a they had a 150 that was called something.
Oh, they bumped to 200.
So the 150, I think, might have gone to 2 or 250.
I think they bumped to 200. The 150 they bumped to 200, and the 100 they bumped to 125, I think. Anyway, It was two bumps to existing plans. That no change. You don't have to sign up for a new plan. It's just whoever has that plan got a speed bump.
It's a small bump. I got Time Warner. I heard they like announced it with great fanfare, where it's like, we're going to double your speed. I was getting 50 megabits at the time. But then by the time they actually did it, it was, no, you've got 300. You just kind of go, okay, wow, six times. No, okay, so I'm pretty satisfied with that.
They've made a big deal about, like, they've upped their speeds, I think, like 17 times last year.
They've upped their speeds, so.
Yeah.
Not on business class.
We don't need to be more regulated. Go away.
Yeah. But the thing is, they also had put in data caps. Of course, the data caps pretty large.
They did that too, so it's a terabyte. It's a terabyte, right now. Yeah. They're giving, I think, everyone 2 months of grace period, and then if you go over the terabyte, they're going to charge you like, I think, like $10 per 50 gigs or something like that over that. And then you can still pay X amount more and get true unlimited, but it's like another 40 or 50 a month to get the true unlimited.
I'm still waiting for, I want gigabit internet mostly because it's both ways, as opposed to the big pipe in and the smaller pipe out. Because that seems to me to be much more useful. But so now we got a couple, we've got our cute human interest story.
Cute.
Where it's the, you know, one in a million thing happened. Aww. Yeah, you know how, like, if you even, like, go outside and it's kind of misty out, then it, like, liquid destroys your phone? Well, BuzzFeed has a remarkable tale of a man, his iPhone 4, and a very cold lake. Pennsylvania resident Michael Guntram was ice fishing in 2015 when his phone slipped out of his pocket and sank to the bottom of Kyle Lake, which was eventually drained that September. This October, Daniel Colgren was walking around the lake's basin with a metal detector when he found an iPhone in an OtterBox case. After cleaning it and tossing it in some rice, he plugged it in, and 2 days later, it worked.
An OtterBox, though, they're usually protected pretty well.
That's probably where they get the credit. Apple, unsurprisingly, was smug about the whole episode. It never ceases to amaze us all the incredible iPhone survival stories our customers shared with us. They're only exceeded by the stupid stories of the ones who think that we should replace their waterlogged phone for free, bringing it in the fishbowl to the So I guess that is amazing, but is that, you know, a one in a million deal? I mean, a year underwater, even in an OtterBox, he must have been pretty paranoid, because that means you have all the ports plugged up, you know, all the little things are closed on the outside. Because I would think if you had the headphone jack part open or any of those kinds of things, the water would pretty much get in and you'd be toast. And then the final one, this one is a more geeky kind of human interest story. You know, we told you how the Touch Bar is basically like got its own processor and is running its own operating system and all that. Well, if you're a hardcore geek, what's the next question after, hey, I got this thing with the new processor and screen on it? Well, if you didn't
watch this,
can you run Doom on it? Then you would be 100% correct here. Developer Adam Bell was able to run a copy of the classic shooter Doom on the new Touch Bar of a new MacBook Pro notebook. Keep in mind that since the Touch Bar is essentially a mini Apple Watch jammed above the notebook keyboard, there's no reason it too can't get involved. Bell stepped up to the plate for this one, uploading a video to YouTube. So if you search for Doom on the MacBook Pro Touch Bar, you can see it.
So, Doom's kind of like the new NetBSD.
Granted, the Touch Bar's 2170 by 60 resolution doesn't make it easy, although the game's sound effects are so evocative, you could presumably navigate levels based on audio alone. In a more useful iteration, Bell also dropped Doom's heads-up display onto the Touch Bar, which certainly fit a lot better, but would be a bit of a pain to use. Yes, it's semi-useless as well as fun, but it is an incredibly cool hack. Because that was the thing. There was a lot of years where can you run Doom on it was sort of the you know, the kind of hack of the that showed you had some skills and that the thing you were hacking it into was worthy. And that's all the Apple news. Should I have gone with the phone thing last so you could do the, you're under the water.
So it looks like Xfinity actually, Xfinity, which is the Comcast internet, bumped people up to 250 is the new speed.
Is it 200 to 250?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe and also, you know, this is interesting too. I can't just add it to my card, otherwise I would. They've also got XL Gigabit Pro that it looks like they're now offering in Houston. So 2,000 up and down.
So it's 2 gig?
2 gig.
Two gigs.
2 gig.
Well, you have to call them to order.
You've got to call, though.
That's just so they can tell you it's not available.
Yeah,
right.
I'm sure. They'll have to tell me that in the morning, though.
That's, the first thing they ask is if you have one of the gold Apple watches.
That's a comedy. or a golden ticket. Did you get the candy bar with the golden ticket in it? No? Well, we'll talk to you later. Go buy a candy bar.
I mean, honestly, it's going to be like, do you live in the part of Houston that Google Fiber might be happening in? No? Oh, well then.
Step out in your front yard. Look to your left. Do you see a giant Xfinity neon sign?
I may be
with an Ethernet port underneath it.
Putting out a call like, who wants some free, you know, Gigabit Pro, and who wants some free microwave equipment, pointing towards my house in their backyard. We can share.
Hey, get a bunch of people who are kind of noobs, and then they kick in, and you're gonna get the two gigabit thing. And you're going to share it with them.
While they're checking their email.
You're going to share it with them. So you run a bunch of 10 base T from your house to them.
A little community co-op. I'm sure there's something in the AUP that says, don't do that. But, you know, who reads those?
I don't know. A few years ago, there was on the news here, there was a guy who was offering, like, discounted internet at some in New York, and the deal, they found this closet where he had signed up and had just racks and racks of cable modems that he basically bought that, pooled it, and then he was selling the internet access to his customers in violation of, obviously, the terms. I think somebody from, like, the cable company, you know, was tracing back, figuring out where this, you know, the utility closet, and walked in there and was shocked, but... Anyways, should we talk about Westworld at this point, or is that one to leave for later?
We might want to talk about Westworld. There's been lots of Westworld things happening. Hold on, let me text Laura and tell her we're talking about Westworld. she's excited. My wife's a huge Westworld fan. Generally, we watch Westworld. Like, we've got the HBO Now, so we... we've got the HBO Now. We have HBO Now, so we fire
it
up.
Is she on the Twitters?
She's on the Twitter. So we'll fire it up at, you know, 8 o'clock on Sundays and watch it, and then immediately start talking about the episode and talk about the episode, like, way too late. And then sometimes rewatch parts and then rewatch it the next day and this whole thing. But yeah, there's been a lot of Westworld stuff happening.
All right, but question, I could have gone to the internet to find this out, but mm-hmm. I didn't. Because I was watching it, and I didn't want to run into any spoilers before the episode.
There's spoilers out there.
I know. But what was the tune? What were the tunes from the last episode?
They did a piano cover a piano cover of Foreigner's "Cold as Ice," which was awesome. There were two more big ones, and I should know this. Let's see, Westworld.
Season one, episode eight.
Piano songs. There were a couple of really good ones.
That Cold as Ice.
House of the Rising Sun.
Back
to Black, Amy Winehouse, and Swan Lake.
That was the
I
act
recognized
one, number two.
The House of the Rising Sun, and that was really well done.
Yeah, that was really good. We also noticed there was kind of a callback to an earlier episode. So, when in the scene in this recent episode where Anthony Hopkins' character and rushes into the lab and Tandy Newton's character is freaking out, she's a robot and he is probably not, he pulls out his little iPad and is able to calm her down by playing a piano recording of Debussy's Reverie.
It's the same song he had playing automatically on the piano in his office with his, like, dedicated piano playing robot. So he's basically got, like, a robot-proof office. If a wild, crazed machine kicks down his office door, the Calm the Machine Down song is already playing on the piano. Not that we have seen any evidence that there would be a wild, crazed machine kicking down his door. But yeah, the big one for me was the Foreigner song. Because when it came on, it was me and Laura, and we had a friend over watching the episode, and they start playing, you know, Foreigner on the player piano, and none of us got it. We were like, what is that? We should know what this song is. This sounds so incredibly familiar. Yeah. What is this song? And then our buddy who was over starts going, she was cold as ice. Like, oh, that's what it is. It was very well done. And it fit with the scene because they were talking about Maeve, who is the Madam Robot, who has gained admin powers as of this last episode and is now able to... Oh, yeah, never mind. Spoiler. Garrett hadn't seen it.
I love Lee.
She got ops.
She got ops. Maeve gets ops.
I figured that was coming. But
Well, the way they do it, I mean, since we're already into spoiler territory, the way they do it is actually really neat. Once she's got her admin power, she's in the bar, and she doesn't, like, you know, wave her hands at a robot to reprogram them or whatever. She actually speaks what she wants to happen narratively. So she, like, the bartender comes up to her and says something like, you know,
you have a bit large bar.
Yeah, Maeve, your tab's really getting big. And Maeve looks at him and she goes, the bartender realized that Maeve's tab was actually in excellent condition, and he was going to give her 2 free drinks. And the bartender kind of blinks and goes, have a couple on the house, Maeve. And so the rest of the episode and the rest of the scenes where she causes things to happen, she doesn't just, you know, wave her hand. She just says it in a narrative voice.
They drive that point that everything is a narrative.
Yeah.
You know, that the storylines are narratives. And, it's getting good. And that means it's almost over.
There's 2 eps left.
Yeah.
It goes to 10. And then, unfortunately, it's looking like season 2 won't air probably until 2018. Mm.
That's a worse spoiler than anything else I've heard tonight.
It's really? It's spoiled.
When's Mr. Robot come back?
January 2018, though.
That would be, what, next summer, I would think.
Yeah.
What's going to fill the gap? I mean, you know, Westworld is
this
one of those...
show will fill the gap.
You'll have some Game of Thrones in summer of 2017. For 7 or 6 or 7 episodes, unfortunately.
Well, no, I just wonder if there'll be another new show that kind of comes in and fills the space between these shows, because Westworld's one of those shows that came out, it's just like instantly...
Well, they had such weird... I mean, Westworld had a kind of a tortured production. They had script issues, they had writer issues, the pilot for Westworld, you have to go to Wikipedia to confirm this, but the pilot was filmed like 3 years ago or something, and there was like a huge gap. And then they shut down production in the middle of the season because they weren't done with the scripts for the back half of the season yet. So, like, season 1 of Westworld was, like, a very tortured, like, almost didn't get finished kind of thing. And everyone was kind of, like, thinking that it was... And it was very expensive. The whole season cost, like, $150 million to make. So, I mean, it was, you know, it's like $15 million an episode, basically. It's massive production costs. And the fear that HBO had, that everybody had, was, like... You know, we're going to, you know, release this $150 million bomb and nobody's going to want to watch it because it's, you know, a cerebral story about cowboy robots. Unfortunately, that's not the case. It's turned out to have the ratings are better than Game of Thrones was in its first season. It's, you know, it's doing massive numbers, which is great because it's a great show. But it is apparently just real expensive to make. And I'm very so much hoping that they end it with... That they wrap season 1 with a conclusion that will keep us
engaged for a year.
Engaged and interested for a year, but not like, you know, not like stab Jon Snow and then cut to black kind of like, I don't want that kind of ending because we got to wait a year and a half, maybe at least a year before we see what happens next. And I just don't
it
think
needs to be more of like, I'm really glad to be taking an intermission now because I got to go to the bathroom for a year.
No idea is that expensive, but I mean, the robots have to be expensive because they look really realistic. Like, it's hard to tell.
I know.
What's a human, what's a robot?
They had to build
so,
those
yeah,
special.
Seriously.
It was very complicated.
That should trickle down to actual real tech.
Well, there is one thing that, there's overlap right now, but it should carry on at least for a few more weeks after Westworld goes out there, is the Grand Tour, has premiered on Amazon.
Oh my gosh, I loved the Grand Tour.
The first episode, and Grand Tour, if you don't know, is the vehicle for Jeremy, the
Top Gear
crew. Yeah, so it's Top Gear.
Clarkson, Hammond,
without the BBC, and the first episode was, oh, it was really good. It was just set the...
It was everything I loved about Top Gear, well, but it's like they cranked the budget and the production values up to 11.
Although there were some things, there were so many nods to Top Gear, it was like watching one of the Star Trek or the Star Wars reboots, because they were like capitalizing on the kind of in-jokes from the old show. But then they were taking digs at the old show, the BBC. Yeah,
with the murdering three celebrities.
it was pretty good, and it was a good, like, here's what we're doing, and I'm really looking forward. It was more of a pure driving show than the kind of wacky challenges kind
for,
of show.
For, I think for people who like cars, and there is an overlap between geeks and cars, somewhat, not as much as you might expect, especially younger geeks don't really care about cars, but if you are like someone who has, you know, automobiles on the brain and in the soul, it is absolutely a good show to watch. If there's anything that the internet, from what I've been reading, didn't like about it, it's that there's kind of a feeling that Clarkson has gotten a free pass for most of his life, and then again recently for terrible bad behavior, you know, because he punched that dude out, and that's why he got fired. In fact, I think it was Variety. If you go read Variety's review of the episode, hold on. I don't want to malign Variety unfairly here. Variety.
Only when I malign them to the level which they deserve. Tour.
I think it was the Variety review. Let me click on this, and then click past their stupid interstitial ad that's going to pop up here. There it is. Yes, it's the Variety review by whoever this person is. 9/10 of the review is about how the Clarkson is basically a symbol of toxic masculinity, and shows about cars are terrible and Clarkson should be thrown in jail. And that's like 9/10 of the review. But other than like stuff like that, I thought the Grand Tour was excellent. Just the opening number, like 5 minutes into the show, I was like, I'm going to love this. This is going to be great.
Burning Van.
Yeah, Burning Van.
Well, as with any show or thing, any musician or celebrity or anything like that, don't pay attention to their personal lives. Don't pay attention to our personal lives. You know, enjoy the product, but it's unfortunate that if you dig into the lives of anybody, you're going to find stuff you don't like. Jeremy Clarkson may be this horrendously horrible person, but you know it because it's been in the news. But there are probably many, many people that you worship and believe in because of the roles they play in the fiction that you watch, that if you knew them personally, you would hate them. You would be disgusted by who they are, because people are really...
Yeah, I've heard Christian Bale doesn't go around beating up criminals at night.
Should I not try and meet Richard Stallman in real life?
You know what? Richard Stallman will, if invited, will come to your house and stay with you. I've read that document.
So Richard Stallman, if we say it one more time, it's like a religious effect.
So will Captain Crunch.
Oh, man.
I was thinking it, but I wasn't saying it.
Yes, the Grand Tour.
You don't want to meet your heroes. That's all I'm saying.
The Grand Tour was excellent. It was well done. I know there was a lot of talk about whether or not the show could survive out of the context of the BBC. Is Top Gear still Top Gear without being the BBC show called Top Gear? Well, unfortunately, the BBC show called Top Gear is terrible without the three of them.
Right.
Even with Chris Evans, who is it?
And Chris Evans is gone. He's out.
Is it Chris Evans or Chris Harris?
Matt LeBlanc, right?
They dumped.
Okay, Chris Harris is the fellow I like. Chris Evans is the terrible one. Even with Chris Harris still doing driving on Top Gear, it's not. And on the other hand, the Grand Tour on Amazon, which is, three idiots doing dumb stuff in cars. It turns out that, the reason people watch the show is to watch those specific three idiots doing dumb stuff in cars. And, I'm sure they're better on the track than I am. I make absolutely no pretensions that I can drive a track car, and they get in those three supercars and wail around the track and they look great. Even if they're, spinning out and they can't get their drag race times right, at the end of the episode, they do this thing where they drag the cars like three times and they get, you know, three different results or whatever, it's still fun to watch them because they're so enthusiastic and happy about what they're doing. It's a good escapist show about driving fast cars fast.
Or they rode some motorcycles slow.
No, yeah, it's not always the case.
That was the Vespa and the old motorcycle.
My point
commercial.
Was is that this first episode was a petrol head show. It was the cars,
the hypercar challenge.
Yeah, it was supercars they were driving and establishing that. What I'm looking forward to are the ridiculous challenges. You know,
yeah,
converting a car to an amphibious vehicle.
It looks like they're coming.
You know, the show that I saw of Top Gear that got me hooked, you know, the first one I ever saw was the Vietnam special.
That's the one that I saw that got me into it, yeah.
And that
yeah.
was like, that was just beyond hilarious. And I was in Belgium when my wife was watching it while I was working on.
Just channel surfing or how
just,
did
just
I
channel
find
surfing
it?
And me not knowing my British celebrities at all, thought that Jeremy Clarkson was Stephen Fry. So in my
you want to get punched.
Well, no, in my efforts to find the show, whatever it was that we had seen, because we'd forgotten that what it was called, you know, we didn't realize it was called Top Gear, didn't know anything about it, had no exposure to it. I'm just working on my computer and Cynthia's just laughing and I'm like, what are you laughing at? And I started paying attention. It was ridiculously funny. So when we got back to the States, I figured I need to find this show and figure out what it was. So I was like, Stephen Fry, Vietnam. Didn't find anything. The internet had nothing on this.
Mysterious.
This is a mysterious show that the internet hasn't even discovered yet.
No, sadly.
Sadly, once I figured out it was Top Gear, then all was right with the world.
Some say his name is Jeremy Clarkson, and he worked for the BBC.
The other thing...
Some say he's afraid of bells. All we know is the show's called Top Gear.
Grand Tour.
It was called Top Gear then. Now it's the Grand Tour.
So
they don't have the Stig. They have the American.
The American NASCAR driver who hates everything that's not an American car. is you know, it's... Yeah,
he was bombing around the track in an M2, a brand new, very beautiful BMW M2. And you're like, this thing couldn't even pull a greased string out of a pig's backside.
So that'll get a couple of weeks into next year, I think. Well, maybe. I don't know what the release schedule is or how many episodes there are. So I have that to look forward to.
Yeah, that's going to be good. That's a fun one. Well, I am a fan. I am unabashedly a fan.
I think next year some animated shows that have taken a break, Adventure Time, is due to come back if one was watching.
I'm not high enough to watch Adventure
Morty.
Time.
Rick and Morty.
Rick and Morty still being produced? Is that still H. John Benjamin? Is it Rick and Morty?
No, that's not H. John Benjamin. That's the Rick and Morty dude is a different dude.
Yeah.
What was the show that you... You're
thinking Archer?
Bob's Burgers?
No, there's another cartoon. You told me to watch it. It was about the scientist and the young guy and one of the...
That's Rick and Morty.
No, that was Pete, maybe. Pete Rick and Morty.
Johnny Quest?
Yeah, Rick and Morty is
Venture Brothers?
Dave Harmon. C-Lab, the guy,
2021.
The Dan Harmon, who did... he did a lot of, you know, comedy shows. He did Community most recently. And then a guy who I can never remember his name. They did like that. They did a really weird VR, the like office.
Accounting, which I just played through. That
and
was fabulous.
Apparently, the guy who created Rick and Morty is just nuts for VR and
yeah.
really wants to explore that. But
VR is pretty great. VR is pretty great, Pete. What do you think of VR?
Watch them with your kids.
I like VR. VR is pretty great. I'm
Listen,
thinking it's
kid.
Good. You like it? Yeah, I really like it. Well, okay. I'm going to go try VR when we get home.
Yeah, I can't do Rick. I can do... When I've heard some episodes, I can do Rick. I mean, I can't do Morty. I can't do the kiddo voice anymore. I saw Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them this weekend in 3D.
And How was the 3D?
The 3D was...
It was like it was coming out of the screen at you.
They didn't take advantage of it. I mean, they didn't abuse it, and there wasn't any moment where you just looked at it and went, wow, because of 3D. It was there and a part of it.
Did they take something that was like a long stick or something and... twisted around, so it went like out at you and made the crowd duck.
No, they had none of that. I saw it on a Sunday night. I figured seeing the 3D one on the at an Alamo Draft House, there were empty seats. It's kind of it was like wow.
Everybody's watching Doctor Strange.
Yeah, in 2D because they didn't have that 3D. That's what we went for initially, and then instead we saw that. It avoids. I know there's some of the people who are very Harry Potter oriented didn't like it because it's not a Harry Potter movie. It's in the universe. It is the first movie in a series of five, and it avoided. I call it the comic book, you know, origin movie problem,
right?
Which is where they get so bogged down in getting you into telling who's what and how's this all work. They did a pretty good job of it. Slowed the movie down to so they could do that, but it didn't. It wasn't fatal.
It's set in the 20s or something.
Yeah, 1920s in New York, and they do take a they use that well. It has a neat style to it.
I want to go check it out.
They still have the schools like the Huff and Stuffs.
The Hufflepuffs.
Hufflepuffer.
It's going to be...
They have a debate about which is the better
Ravenclaw,
school, the American one or the British one.
So you said five more movies. I was disappointed to find out it's going to take like 8 years to do all five movies. No, seriously, I think like the last one's scheduled for like 2017
Daddy got to get paid.
2027.
Everybody got to get paid.
And they also don't have to worry about Eddie Redmayne aging out of the park like they did when they did the Harry Potter movies. You know, you didn't want the supposedly 17-year-old Harry Potter to have a big full beard and, you know, Hermione to look like she's already had a couple kids and all that sort of stuff. But, we didn't really get to Tri-Buyer Fry tonight, and we're coming up towards the end. There's a couple quickies. I'll give you a couple free ones.
Tri-Buyer Fry. How about a McLaren P1? Tri-Buyer Fry.
We won't play the intro in the interest of time. Did you ever wish that you could play Microsoft Solitaire on something other than Windows? Because now it's free for iOS and Android.
I've often wondered what it would be like if there was a real-life version of that game. Wouldn't that be cool?
That you could just take with you on the bus having to bring a Windows laptop. They have released that. There is a mobile version. It includes FreeCell, Klondike, Spider, Tri-Peaks, and Pyramid game modes. And it will sport Xbox Live integration, so you won't have to play it alone.
What?
Solitaire.
No more solitaire.
So it is free, but there is a premium edition which removes ads and doubles coin rewards. The last one, you'll have to go look it up. It's called Firefox Focus, and apparently it is a browser for your phone. Yeah, your phone. And it does more than like private mode on a laptop, so that might be something worth checking out if you're like wanting to do some surfing that is not tracked, like with ad cookies and so on.
Cool.
See you on the other side of Cyber Monday.
Yeah, Cyber Monday's coming up. Be prepared. Black Friday. If you're not, all those all of our listeners camped out in front of Best Buy for the last 2 weeks. Well, thank you for tuning in.
Don't leave your home.
You have been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
Have a great Thanksgiving, everyone.
KPFT is seeking local organizations, businesses, and individuals to take part in our Community Partner Program. Community partners help KPFT through supporting initiatives of the station, reducing our pledge drives, and be key contributors to our success. As a community partner, your organization or business becomes invested in a richer way in KPFT. You help keep important independent radio flowing. Interested in being a community partner? Contact Development Director Robin Lewis anytime. Just call 713-526-4000 or just send an email to robin@kpft.org. Thanks for your interest in our Community Partners Program. This is KPFT Houston.
Supporting KPFT with a legacy gift is an easy decision to make. The future growth and excellence of our station depends on our ability to also build a permanent base of support through an active and successful legacy gift program. The next time you meet with your advisors to review your long-term financial plans, please remember you can include KPFT. Ensure your commitment to public broadcasting continues on. If you need help or have questions, call our development director at 713-526-4000. Again, that's 713-526-4000. Please join listeners like you in helping to ensure that the independent voice of KPFT will be preserved for generations to come. Name KPFT as a beneficiary in your way, in your way, beneficiary in your way, beneficiary in your way, in your way, beneficiary in your way, in your way.